Okay, sorry about that. I decided to start the recording without even having my microphone on, so that should tell you something. No, I'm having a good day. Welcome to All My Darlings, where we are reading Harp Song for a Radical, The Life and Times of Eugene Victor Debs by Marguerite Young. I've got another fairly long chapter for this book. Yeah, okay. Well, we'll be here for about the next half hour. Usually takes me that long to read this much. We're on page 139, chapter 38. Mark Twain gave some small moment of remembrance that once during his travels through the still untrammeled western wilderness, through which he had gone with his brother Orion by overland stagecoach in 1862, thus 10 years before the elaboration extension of his original Notes in Roughing It, published in 1872, he had come into contact with the Mormons, who had taken flight from Missouri and Illinois to the deserts of Utah, under the leadership of Brigham Young, who was called the Golden Lion of the Tribe of Zion. Since many had been drawn by the silver lodes to the far west, but had not reported what they had seen with their own eyes walking on, while on the ground, it had been Mark Twain's intention to help the resting reader while away an hour with his impressions of an interesting episode that he had seen during the time of the rise, growth, and culmination of the silver mining fever in Nevada. As he'd explained in his prefatory, his fear was that, taking it all around, a good deal of information had gotten into his book, to his great regret, but it really could not be helped. Sometimes Mark Twain had been of that mind in which he would give up worlds if he could retain his facts, but it could not be. As for the 19th century, it may be said that it was probably the leakiest century there ever was, and so would remain. One of Brigham Young's memories of the long passage of himself and his ragged, dying people from Nauvoo to the Utopia, which was then nowhere, was that flocks of angels of the Lord had leaked enough buckets of tears from their eyes to make a lake, and now the rain had swept against the broken windows of the Overland Express, in which Samuel Clemens, he was not yet Mark Twain, and his elder brother Orion had traveled, so that in order to protect the passengers from the rain, the stagecoach driver had caulked the sides of the torn curtains to the warped frames with rags made of strips of old clothes, as over appearing and disappearing roads, places of sand and stone where the roads were lost or had never been, or forked between nowhere and nowhere, the coach still had made progress toward Brigham Young's Utopia, which the Golden Lion had founded when it was nowhere. To Mark Twain, coming over the long shoulders of the Rocky Mountains, the long range had seemed like a great China wall protecting the great Salt Lake City, which was the capital city in the empire ruled over by Brigham Young. Perhaps the image of the China Wall had occurred to him because of the fact that, indeed, early discoverers of the Great Salt Lake and many coming afterward had thought that it was a sea from which they could sail directly to the mysterious Orient. Viewed from the top, the city of the Latter-day Saints had seemed a toy village upon the distant plain. Mark Twain had known much of the anti-Mormon conspiratorial apparatus that acted in behalf of the somewhat shaky United States government in Washington, and of invasive, genteel business interests for whom the golden apples of the Mormon polygamists provided irresistible temptation to put their long, sharp teeth into the fruit of the man who had made the Dead Sea to flower. But his stay in the Mormon paradise had been only about 2 days and 3 nights, scarcely time for the unwrapping and solving of all the mysteries of what was called the Mormon question, just as busily sightseeing in Greater Salt Lake City, where he and his brother Orion had found sanctuary as guests of the genteel acting territorial governor in the Salt Lake House, he had never gotten around to taking the horse and buggy ride to the Great Salt Lake, which had traveled so far to behold. As Mark Twain and his brother Orion had walked in the long twilight through the streets of Greater Salt Lake City, they had been impressed by their first glimpse of shops and stores, and by every passing creature they took to be a Mormon. This was a fairyland to us, to all intents and purposes, a land of enchantment and goblins and awful mystery. They had yearned to ask every child along the way how many mothers it had, and if it could tell them apart, had experienced a thrill every time the door of a dwelling house opened and shut as they passed, and they caught a glimpse of human heads and backs and shoulders, for they yearned to see a Mormon family in what Twain described as all its comprehensive ampleness when disposed in the customary concentric rings of its home circle. The image he employed is perhaps consciously astronomical, as the Mormon home circle included both the living and the dead, and surely he knew that there were no orphans sleeping in gutters or starving for a few crumbs or bread, as there were in capitalistic towns, and that all orphans were taken in and sheltered by many mothers and fathers in the kingdom of Brigham Young. The legend has come down that once when the Golden Lion found two starving, wizened little Indians, brother and sister who, like desert mice, had nothing to drink but the few drops of water they sucked from the roots of cactus plants, he had picked them up in his arms, and when asked what he planned to do with them, had answered that he would take them home, of course, and bring them up with his other children as Mr. and Miss Young. And so he did. Mark Twain and his brother Orion, strolling about through the broad, straight, level streets of the sunlit city the day after their arrival, had enjoyed the pleasant strangeness of the most unusual fact that there were no loafers or drunkards perceptible anywhere, that there were limpid streams flowing through every street from the canal in place of filthy gutters, block after block of houses built of frame and sunburned brick, each with thriving orchard and garden at its back, branches of water from the great stream winding among the vegetable beds and trees bearing fruits. And there must have been the portioned apple tree from which hung the hangman's fruit, although there should have been, yet all was very peaceful. People everywhere were busily at work in shops and factories and all manners of industries, Mark Twain recording that there were intent faces and busy hands. He did not liken them to doves, while what struck his ears were those sounds that he remembered as the ceaseless clink of hammers, the buzz of trade, the contented hum of drums, and flywheels. Honey, you need to lay down. Come on, lay down. Lay down and rest. We will go in a second. I promise. The Mormon crest was easy for Twain to understand. It was simple and unostentatious. It had seemed to him to fit like a glove. It was a representative of a golden beehive with the bees all at work. It was the younger brother who was providing the dollars for this journey in search of money, who had visited the foundations of the Mormon temple, which was then in the process of being built upward from the ground, and had seen the tithing house and the lion house and many more church and government buildings of various kinds and curious names, which by the time of the writing of Roughing It had slipped from his mind. The two travelers from Missouri had dined with their genteel hosts, who had regaled them with all kinds of strange tales regarding the Mormons. They had emerged from the Salt Lake House in their best clothes for their call on Brigham Young, the very thought of whom had filled Mark Twain's somewhat porous brain with awe. Merely mortal travelers, especially if from Missouri, might not have been received into Brigham Young's presence. But Orion was on an official mission, having received from Abraham Lincoln as a reward for supporting him in the presidential election campaign of 1860, the office of Secretary of the Nevada Territory. Wearing white shirts, two gentlemen had gone to pay their respects to the Golden Lion of the tribe of Judah, whom they had approached with as much respect as if they were paying a state visit to a king, a man who must not have seemed a caged lion to them, although a lion behind bars and hedged in on every side by contending armies was what he was. And yet, from Mark Twain's point of view, he was the king. The lion house in which the king lived with his numerous wives and numerous children, he was good at keeping count of all things, including the ears of corn and the number of the dead, who continued in the Mormon greater family. He must surely have known how many there were, although, with his sense of enlarged fatherhood, he was not the kind of man who would have kicked out any poor, starving woman or stray child who had come out of the desert or out of the mountains into what others might consider a lion's fold, but what to him, with his shepherding instinct and his millennial ram's horn, must have seemed a sheep's fold for the ewes and the lambs who were gathered in under the protective hand of God, was and would continue to be a wonder to other travelers. Because this harbor for a pluralistic household was marked out by the sign of a crouching lion upon the portico of the front entrance of the gabled, many-celled, thick-walled abode where Brigham Young laughed with his wives and children after a long day's work, which might be followed by a long night's work. The lion house had been built to contain a schoolroom, recreation room, washroom or laundry, dish room, buttery, weaving room for busy looms which made a sound more wonderful than the songs of harps, ash shed for the making of soap, although cleanliness was not necessarily next to godliness these previous mud crawlers knew, and a shelter for the coachman's coach. In his compound there were also shops for the sawing of logs, sheds for poultry, where no doubt the rooster reigned supreme over the hens as in a Morocco courtyard, where the hens were in purdah, and there were numerous farm properties owned by him including shelters for horses and buggies and wagons and mules and cows and a threshing machine and several plows and harrows and a sleigh and a gold watch and chain and 3 silver watches and 6 clocks of beautiful design and workmanship, like everything else from Brigham Young's hands or the hands of his workers. The place where he received his visitors, some of an eminence who might find their names unknown to him in this desert wild, for his only concerns were those of his Israel, that it might not be pulverized, beaten back into the dust and sand like that through which it had come, that it might survive by begetting and multiplying and extending as God had promised, was his office between the Beehive House and Lion House, actually an extension of the Honey Hive, where he kept his actuarial accounts on the progress of the living and the dead, the material and the spiritual orbs. Mysteries were not mysteries, but came through man's inadequate understanding of the chemistry of God. Mystery was nothing to Brigham Young. The Mormons were under the protection of the hand of God, and had been through all the way by which, after the burnings at Nauvoo, Latter-day Saints had come into Utah for the erection of the great Salt Lake City upon the desert floor, by all working in harmony together for the good of all, and not of one interested only in self-advancement, and buying low and selling high. Brigham Young cried out through his ram's horn, "We have been kicked out of the frying pan, into the fire, out of the fire, into the middle of the desert floor, and here we are, and here we will stay." To later handcart immigrants, mainly English and Welsh and German and Scandinavian, he had advised that they should not search the sky for the angelic beings who actually, of course, thicken the air about them, but should dig ditches for irrigation and dig holes for the planting of the turnip. Why always a turnip? Turnips are horrible. No. Brigham Young was never so wrapped up in the spiritual that he forgot to give practical advice. He understood that if any one of his 12 apostles whom he had expected to rule with him as kings over the deserts and the mountains for the good of the Mormon people should disagree with him, there still would be stamped upon each of them the sign that he was and always would be a Mormon at heart. Brigham Young was as full of wise sayings as if he were an edition not of the Mormon Bible, but of Poor Richard's Almanac. He did not know that sometimes his advice went like a shuttle into a Mormon's ear and came out at the other ear without leaving so much as a thread of understanding to show that it had passed in and out. He measured every keg of water or keg of salt and struck its top with his gold-headed cane to make sure that neither salt nor water leaked out. While underpaid stocking knitters who knit stockings by machines in the attics owned by the stocking kings and blasted industrial cities of the East were either blinded by their long hours of work or were expressing social protest by knitting stockings that would fit no feet, he had advised the women who were hand knitters in his knitting shop to give greater care to their knitting, ribbing, and pearly. It was his belief that little children in the Mormon settlement should not be sent out to the deserts and the mountains to round up the cattle and the sheep and the lambs. They should spend their time in school in the midst of such pleasant gardens of fruits and flowers and vegetables filled with splashings of waters and the singing of birds and the buzzings of bees that they should never wish to leave home. The legend has come down that once, when Father Young had paid a call at a home in a remote pioneering settlement, that of Anson Call, who had answered the Lord's call to help protect the Mormon kingdom, he had been sitting before the fireplace with his host's little golden-haired daughter on his knees as he explained his love of the children whom he desired should be educated and play in green fields, when the cherubic child had said to him, "Mr. Young, your eyes look exactly like the eyes of my father, Sal." Walking tiptoe with the little girl leading him by the hand, he had gone out with her to the pig shed so he might see what the sow's face looked like, and stood studying her features for some time as if she were his living reproduction or portrait. If the Mormon kingdom, stretching out like a hog's back in the desert in the shadow of the mountains, had really been a hog, then its back would have bristled with the swords of territorial troops who had been sent to watch over the Mormons and impose their peace upon the wandering remnant tribes of starving red men by making war, war that seemed to have no intent but extermination. So, to add to this, because things have happened since the 1800s, so polygamy was a thing. I believe that's illegal in the U.S. now, but Mormons did practice polygamy even then. They just formed, I don't know, what I would call cults around it that were abusive, and you can see the documentaries that end up being abusive and with sexual abuse, pedophile, all kinds of good stuff. So, and they would kick out the boys. So they wanted to keep the girls because those would be married off to men. So they would have lots and lots of wives. But boys were competition. So they would excommunicate the boys and basically kick them out of the cult. So that is, you know, they were a nice little tidbit to all this stuff, information. The white-shirted Mark Twain and his brother Orion felt a certain sense of awe that they should have the privilege of making a state visit to the king, whom the clowning comedian would describe as ruling over a Mormon state which was no state at all, but a state of mind. Mark Twain would have been pleasantly surprised if he had ever found out that the man who kept record of visitors calling to see Brigham Young had entered the names of the two callers that hot August day as the brothers Orion and Samuel Clemens. The stateless king to whom they had paid their state visit was a kindly, easy-mannered, dignified, self-possessed old gentleman who had in his eye a gentle craft that probably belonged there. He was very simply dressed and was just taking off a straw hat as we entered. It was Brigham Young's belief that this earth had once been closer to the moon than it now was, and that because of a great sin, it had been dropped to this distance, but it would bounce back when came the millennium in which the Mormons would be reunited with their dead and would prevail, although now subjected to persecution in many forms. That would, like, have destroyed the earth. But, okay, sure. The Mormons, who were a small stone, would triumph over the genteel intruders by breaking the large stones into fragments. The great patriarch of the Mormons usually took advantage of the presence of visitors, passing into and out of the great Salt Lake City by scattering the seeds of propaganda, which might give a better portrait of the gatherings of Latter-day Saints than they generally enjoyed in the Zion that was the envy of Babylonians. The head of the Golden Beehive in this greater Salt Lake, while discoursing upon Utah and the Indians and Nevada and general American matters and questions, had paid no attention to Orion Clemens' brother, Samuel. Although Samuel had made several attempts from the sidelines to draw Young out on such subjects as federal politics and that which he considered to be Young's high-handed attitude toward Congress. I thought some of the things I said were rather fine. Brigham Young had merely looked around at him at distant intervals, thus reminding Samuel Clemens of the image of a benign old cat, which he had sometimes seen looking around to see which kitten was meddling with her tail. So that Orion Clemens's younger brother had subsided into an indignant silence throughout which, hot and flushed, he had sat until the end while execrating Young in his heart as an ignorant savage. But as for Brigham Young, he had remained calm, his conversation with the official gentleman flowing on as sweetly and peacefully and musically as any summer brook. Only when they were retiring from his presence, Brigham Young had put his hand upon the head of Samuel Clemens, beaming down on him in an admiring way as he said to his brother, "Ah, your child, I presume? Boy or girl?" In comparing Brigham Young with the old cat, the author of Roughing It had perhaps not had in mind the image of the cat who was sacred in Egypt and other eastern lands as a watcher over the dead in Scandinavia, as in some other northern countries, was sacred as a watcher over the corn ears, lest they should be nibbled away by mice, and was revered in particular for its eyes, which were as refulgent as with light as the moon. The moon brilliance of the cat's eyes had given rise to the belief that the cat had healing powers. Maybe not their eyes, but their purrs do. They're so sweet. For a while, he said, with what iconic Samuel Clemens described as the gushing self-sufficiency of youth, he had thought of staying on in the desert kingdom of salt and stone in order to plunge headlong into the work of anti-polygamous reform. But that was before he had seen, according to his assiduously comic portrait, which showed largely his own biases, the poor, ungainly, and pathetically homely wives who were the wives of Brigham Young. Soon thinking better of his original sentiment, however, and not succumbing to the temptation to allow his head to be ruled by his heart, he had observed, regarding Brigham Young and the number of wives who were rumored to be his, "No, the man that marries one of them had done an act of Christian charity which entitles him to the kindly applause of mankind, not their harsh censure. And the man that marries 60 of them had done a deed of open-handed generosity so sublime that the nation should stand uncovered in his presence and worship in silence." Oh, screw you. The gentleman, Orion Samuel Clemens, allowed her no child, although he had wished to seem more naive than he was, possibly an innocent abroad in his own country, had at least in retrospect seemed to believe, when the news could have come as no news to them, the tales of Mormon violence that they had heard during their last night in Great Salt Lake City, when they had sat smoking pipes in a den of Gentiles and had been told how a heedless people who came into Utah made remarks against Brigham Young or his polygamous society were likely to disappear during the night and be found the next morning lying in a back alley, contentedly waiting for the hearse. Their Gentile hosts had told Orion and his brother Samuel, the former Mississippi River boat pilot, who had known the ever-shifting river from the ruins of Nauvoo downward to St. Louis, port city to the land of the Missouri mule skinners, from which the Mormon polygamists, who had already been driven from Ohio, had been driven as from Iowa and Illinois, the Brigham Young's Lion House, or Henry in Utah, contained 20 or 30 wives, each with her children, amounting to about 50 altogether. This number must have been a rough count in a kingdom of so many mysteries, as this which was headed by the great golden lion of Judah, or archer of God. And this was a kingdom in which not even the poorest Mormons and their wives and children starved, while only the rich ate well. The Clemens brothers had not been given the opportunity of eating at the table of the very fatherly and motherly Brigham Young, so they had had to depend upon the eyewitness account given to them by a Gentile by the name of Johnson, as to what the domestic life was like in the inner sanctum of the Lion House. This fictional Mr. Johnson, who is evidently Samuel Clemens's alter ego, had told a preposterous tale regarding a social breakfast that he had enjoyed with Mr. Young in the general dining room in the Lion House. The only carnage that had occurred was when, after the calling of the roll, the buckwheat cakes were brought in for serving to the children, and one could imagine that they were stacked up as tall towers upon the platters and were dripping with butter and honey as if they were a manna that had come down from the clouds. But the fields from which the buckwheat cakes were made had been planted by the Mormons themselves when they were a starving tent people in this desert wild where there was no water. How much different the plentitude of children running around like chicks all over the place in the Henry of which Mr. Young was chanticleer must have seemed to the Clemens brothers, Orion and Samuel, from the lives of poor children who slept in gutters in many industrial cities, and who on lonely farms were often stamped down into clay and mud by their parents in the struggle for survival, and many of whom were now being orphaned by the Civil War, in which the territories took no part, although in these far regions the red men with their remnant tribal family systems were being cut down and their children made into orphans by the same regiments that would like to turn their birdshot upon the Mormon flocks as of old. But Mr. Johnson was not the kind of equable news hound who was capable of pointing this out to the travelers listening in the Gentile den. The younger, with his dream of finding a mine of silver, he would have settled for gold or lead or any other metal in order that he might enjoy a butterfly existence in San Francisco. But such was not to be his, the only veins from which he might drain the wealth being those of his comic sense. So just to be clear, I mean, I'm not like trying to harshly judge polygamists. I think all of the systems suck because all of this, like, it's no different. Whether you have many wives, whether Muslim religions, you're allowed so many wives, whether you're in the Western countries where you get to divorce and remarry, divorce and remarry, divorce and remarry, divorce and remarry, thus having many wives. I mean, that's all, it's all set up. It's patriarchy, so it's all set up to benefit men. And it's all one and the same, it's just different names. And even marriage, read a really good newsletter. I can't remember, it was off of Substack. Liz Lentz, I think. It's called Men Yell at Me. That's the name of the Substack. I'm on Substack. So, and I'm enjoying so far. I don't pay for, like, this idea where I have to pay for every single news source. I read a lot. So the idea that I am going to pay, I don't care how much a basic membership is, for every single news source or newsletter that I want to read, is just not going to happen. So I get it. People have, you know, rally around it. Plus, I'm always afraid that, I mean, that's not, my critique of that is that's not going to work. Because then you're just getting that one person's point of view. And even though that one person's point of view might be great, Might be everything you've ever wanted. It's still only one. So it sets you up for all kinds of biases on regarding everything else. So yeah, sorry, I want like, I just want regular newspapers backers. Not that, but at least diversity. I want diversity and I can't pay for the amount of diversity that I would like. So, but more power to them. They're doing great. A lot of them have very successful newsletters. The one was the critique on marriage and another critique on marriage, because you know, even though bringing in current events, the Republicans don't have a leader. They're batshit crazy, besides just being Nazis right now, and just trying to out-Nazi each other. Their leader is going to jail, hopefully, or at least have lots and lots of bad stuff happen to him, as he deserves, with all the fraud and just a lifetime of crap that he's done. Which is a matter of public record. Why do supporters not know this? I have no idea. I don't know. I can't explain any of this. But anyways, the party called the Republicans. We're trying to make these draconian cuts to all kinds of welfare. We know the child care expansion that had been funded over COVID-19, it was expired. Women no longer have reproductive rights, so they are now forced to carry children. All of this without universal health care, paid parental and maternal leave, without child care, without support of any kind. And someone brought it up and it was like, oh yeah, made perfect sense. This is by design. And the reason this is by design is because they're also going after no-fault divorce. They don't want women to be able to get a divorce. Trust me, it's women. So they don't want them to be able to get a divorce and men can just turn around and have whatever other women they want. That's just the way it works. Patriarchy works. So they want to do away with a no-fault divorce. And somebody pointed out the intersection between forcing women to have children while providing zero support for those children in any way, shape, or form, and also preventing women from getting married, thereby forcing them to marry in order to get the support they need. That's what marriage has become in the U.S., a way for women and children to supposedly receive the support that they need from their husbands solely and only within that family, so that one, nothing for women and children need to be funded at all. It can all be done away with. And if you just force women to have children and marry, then that whole social system will take care of itself. I hope that sounds absolute effing as crazy to you as it does to me. I'm not going to be happy. Just pass the Equal Rights Amendment. Just pass the Equal Rights Amendment. What are you worried about? Just pass the Equal Rights Amendment. Add that on there. I want full bodily autonomy. I want the Equal Rights Amendment. And all the rest will follow. Everything else outside of this that they're talking about is a diversion. I would also like half of the military budget dedicated to women and children. I would also like that too. But if 51% of women control and run businesses, run and control the government, run and control, own half of everything, if all that happened, then those changes would probably come about anyways. Anywho. But. So yeah, I wasn't trying to pick on the Mormons. All right. Thank you for listening. Hope you're well where you are. Bye.